My introduction went. My name is Pamela Mejia, and I'm here to present Berkeley Media Studies Group's findings on news coverage of child sexual abuse from 2007 to 2009. I want to start by just acknowledging and thanking my co-researchers and writers, Lori Dorfman, the founder of Berkeley Media Studies Group, and Andrew Shane, as well as Priscilla Gonzalez, who couldn't be here today, but who did a lot of the coding. I've been told I talk a little fast. I will try very hard to keep slow. If I'm going too fast, feel free to gesture wildly at me. I'll try to slow down. So I wanted to start by introducing Berkeley Media Studies Group a little bit, giving some background on what it is that we do and why. At the Berkeley Media Studies Group, we research how the news covers public health issues to provide media advocacy training and strategic consultation for community groups and public health advocates who want to work with the media to advance their policy goals. We also provide professional education for journalists seeking to write more effectively about public health issues. We're often asked, why the news? Why do you study the news? And it's because we're interested in changing environments, as is everyone in public health, and changing communities. And the best way to do that, we believe, is to reach the policymakers whose decisions shape those communities. And to do that, we use the news. For many policymakers, the news is how they learn about an issue, especially a taboo issue like child sexual abuse. It's also how they can gauge the public's interest in that issue and the kinds of solutions that are acceptable. So, I can use that. Okay. So, to that end, we really are interested in focusing on how the news is covering the issues of interest to public health advocates. And in this case, our issue of interest was child sexual abuse. And child sexual abuse is not well covered in the news. It's very infrequently covered, and when it is, the coverage follows a really typical pattern. And I use this cartoon, which I'm going to kind of narrate us through, because I think it gives a good illustration of how, when it does appear, child sexual abuse is covered. Our friend Wolf Blitzer is here, live in the Situation Room, where he is eagerly awaiting the next saga of a missing or murdered child, which when a little girl interjects and says, excuse me, Mr. Wolf, hello, little girl, have you been kidnapped or murdered? He's thinking, please say yes. She replies, no, you see, every year, millions of children like me die from easily preventable disease and malnutrition brought on by war and poverty, never to be covered by the media in mind-numbing detail, at which point she's cut off when he says, okay, you need to work on that pitch. We went to a break 10 seconds ago. So it's a comic that has a lot of different levels to it, but the reason that I use it is because I think it speaks to how child sexual abuse is covered. It's absent from the media until a highly scandalous or salacious case of a kidnapped, murdered, or in this case, molested child appears on the landscape. And then it's covered by CNN, by MSNBC, by Nancy Grace, by anyone you can think of in mind-numbing detail, until that case disappears from the news cycle. And then it disappears completely from the news until the next major scandal appears. So studies have shown that except in years when a high-profile scandal is on the horizon or is on the landscape, this issue is completely absent from news coverage. And so if policymakers are learning about this issue from the news, we're concerned about what they're getting from this kind of coverage and how the policies they shape respond. So to that end, we wanted to study news coverage in the absence of a major scandal, to see how child sexual abuse is being covered when Wolf Blitzer isn't in the Situation Room. What kinds of truths does it impart, or misconceptions does it reconfirm? Wait, I think I'm going backward. Okay. So we did an analysis of news coverage from 2007 to 2009. This was, it says here, a newspaper sample of routine coverage, and I want to unpack that statement just a little bit. First of all, routine coverage means that we specifically designed our sample to exclude stories about the major scandal of that time period, which, as most of you are probably aware, was the scandals within the Catholic Church. While those stories and the pressure that they put on the church for reform were very important, again, we're interested in seeing what's happening at the baseline. The other thing I want to point out is that it says that it's a newspaper sample. So we're often asked, why study newspapers in this era of new media? And that's because even in these times of new media, newspapers still set the agenda for what's covered by other story, by other media types. So we developed a coding instrument that was quite comprehensive and was designed to capture information on two levels. For each article, we looked at article-level information. Sorry to be a little redundant there. We looked at information about where the story was published, how long it was, what newspaper it appeared in, what the topic was. Lots of information about the article as a whole. And then we went a little deeper, and we looked at instances of child sexual abuse that were reported in each story. And to just determine how reporters are talking about this very sensitive and taboo issue, we coded whatever information was available about those cases. Okay? So demographic information about the victims and abused, information about the whatever was available about the type of abuse, things like that. So that was for each article. It was quite a comprehensive coding instrument, as you can imagine. And there's a lot of potential for readers, for coders, to view the information in different ways. So we did do some coder training to make sure we had very strong intercoder reliability before we started coding and analyzing the sample. All right, so as was mentioned, my first degree is in biochemistry. I'm a real science person, and I love results, and I love methods, but I tried to get through the methods really quickly. I hope I did. And now I'm going to just skim over the results really quickly, give you our top-line findings, and then we're going to go a little deeper into some of our more interesting findings that I think have had a lot of resonance for the child sexual abuse advocates who use this work. So the first thing I want to spotlight is that news coverage is infrequent. As we expected, we saw fewer than 2 stories a week on average about this issue appearing in newspapers from 2007 to 2009. Coverage focuses on specific cases at moments in the criminal justice process, and I'll unpack that in a moment. Prevention is virtually invisible. Language is across the board quite vague and imprecise. And speakers, the majority of whom are criminal justice professionals, focus on the details of specific incidences rather than on solutions. Grab a little water here. So the first result that I really want to highlight has to do with the criminal justice process. Many, many different data points support this finding, but I'm just going to highlight one here. We found many different pieces of information that supported our finding, as I said, that coverage focuses on moments in criminal justice. And one of the most telling was this finding about news hooks. Now, news hooks is a phrase that we use to refer to the trigger for why a story appeared in the paper that day. Okay? News process is very competitive, of course, so what is it that makes this story particularly notable to an editor or writer? And as you see here, in the overwhelming majority of cases, the stories were in the paper that day because a specific case had reached an end point in the criminal justice process, arrest, arraignment, indictment, etc. In far fewer instances, stories were in the paper because of some other news hook, like they were controversial, there was a breakthrough in an old case, or the anniversary of a particularly notable case. Some stories, very small percentage, had local interest or focused on an injustice, like a wrongfully accused individual. In a very few cases, I'll just mention these last two because they're a little complex, we saw stories that were in the news because of an ironic or unusual situation, like a convicted pedophile who was spared prison because the judge thought that his childlike appearance would make him vulnerable in jail. We also saw a couple of stories that had a pop culture focus, like about the stories about the release of the movie Precious, which deals with an incest survivor. But overall, what I want folks to come away from this slide with is the understanding that these stories were considered notable and newsworthy because of their criminal justice importance. The other thing I want to highlight is that prevention is virtually invisible. So this is a bit of a complex slide. I worked really hard to make it as transparent as possible, but I'll talk you through it. First of all, let me stress that the majority of articles, we said 260 articles, and of those, only 78, less than one-third, mentioned any kind of solution at all. Okay. So the bulk of these articles, this 182 on our left-hand side in the orange bar, do not refer to any solutions to child abuse at all, child sexual abuse at all. They just talk about the details of a case. Of that 78 articles, that one-third or less, that talk about solutions, the majority talk about interventions, which are coded in blue. Now, interventions are solutions that are designed to address issues of child sexual abuse that have already happened. So they're meant to penalize convicted offenders or rehabilitate survivors. And there's two different levels of blue here, and that's because we looked at whether the interventions talked about the environment or just the individual. So environmental level interventions, which were the biggest of these solutions, were things like build more prisons or have longer prison terms for offenders in general. Individual level interventions, that light blue bar, refers to interventions targeted on an individual. Let's have a longer prison term for this specific offender who committed a crime. Let's have more prisons so that we can punish offenders like this one. Now, in this very small green bars, we see prevention appearing. So that is 18% of the 78 articles that talked about prevention, that talked about solutions. So that's a very small fraction of that larger universe of articles. Very, very small number of articles talked about prevention. And they talked about both individual level prevention, like community groups to talk to parents about preventing child abuse in schools. And then there were also some environmental level preventative measures that were discussed. But I want to highlight that all the environmental level preventions that were discussed really focused on changing social norms. So these would be things like, let's destigmatize child sexual abuse so that victims feel empowered to come forward about their experience and break the cycle of abuse. But we never saw reference to a concrete preventative policy. For instance, Darkness to Light is working on advocating a policy whereby in federally funded schools and camps, no one child can be left alone with one adult. That's a concrete preventative measure, and we never saw reference to that policy or any like it in our news coverage. Okay. So I just want to leave you with the idea that prevention, when it appears, is very infrequent, and it's somewhat more ephemeral and focused on social norm shift. The last thing I want to talk about is framing. Frames are how the stories arrange information so that it makes sense to the viewer, the news consumer. No one story can tell us everything. So the frames that we come to a story with help us make sense of the information that's presented. And that can be a problem when the dominant frames aren't ones that are particularly conducive to the public health change we want to see. So the two frames that we talk about the most in media advocacy and public health are the portrait and landscape frames. The portrait frame, which we can all envision pretty quickly when I describe it, puts the issue in the context of the story of an individual or maybe a family or a small group. Okay, so we can all envision that story, the child who overcomes adversity to become the valedictorian of their high school. Meanwhile, a landscape frame puts the story in a larger context. It pulls back from that individual to show the structures and social forces that underlie that problem. So maybe not the story of one individual overcoming adversity, but a struggling school district faced by budget cuts. Okay. So we were interested in seeing how the majority of stories framed, whether they used the portrait of the landscape frame. And it wasn't surprising that 80% of the stories we saw used a very tight portrait frame around an individual victim, abuser, or case. Only 20% of the stories that we saw took a landscape frame and pulled back to show, in a larger sense, some of the underlying issues surrounding child sexual abuse. We think framing is pretty important for a number of reasons, and the biggest one is that the frames that we see, really affect how viewers and news consumers respond to those stories and where they see the solutions. When we have a tight portrait frame, like I talked about before, first of all, if it's a tight frame, it can make the problem seem really insurmountable. We're not seeing the solutions, we're not seeing the broader context, so it just seems like one case after another of horrifying child sexual abuse with no landscape for prevention and no context to put it all in focus. When we have that tight criminal justice portrait frame, there's no role for child sexual abuse advocates. It seems like criminal justice is the only solution. Public health and prevention has no place. And finally, when we have a portrait frame, viewers can tend to see the solution to the problem as lying with the individual who's profiled. That is, they can be more likely to blame the victim. Whereas when we have a landscape frame, that wider frame, we're more likely to see institutions, schools, governments, industries, etc., as having both a role in and a role in solving the problem. Okay. Now you might be thinking, well, no one would blame the victim in a story of child sexual abuse, but unfortunately, as readers of the New York Times can attest, in March of this year, there was a highly controversial story where an episodic frame, or excuse me, I keep saying episodic, I mean portrait frame, where a portrait frame really ended up producing a lot of victim-blaming language around the 11-year-old victim of a gang rape in Texas. And that story inspired a lot of backlash and shows the need to reframe. We at the Berkeley Media Studies Group encourage advocates to work on broadening that frame through a variety of ways, through monitoring the media to be aware of how the issue is being reported. And when you're not seeing the news that you want, to create news or piggyback on breaking news stories to talk about the issues that you want to see. We saw that the opinion space was very underutilized, so we encourage advocates to use letters to the editor, editorials, and op-eds to make news and to broaden the frame around child sexual abuse. To whenever you're talking about child sexual abuse, to invoke systems and context. And finally, we found that advocates and public health professionals are very underquoted, so we really encourage advocates to work with survivors of child sexual abuse, to train them as spokespeople who can provide a compelling voice for the broader frames that we want to see around child sexual abuse. In closing, I'd like to encourage you to visit our newly revamped website, bmsg.org, to download issue 19, if you haven't read it already, on child sexual abuse. And so please feel free to talk to me after or at any time via email, because we're very, very interested in continuing to expand our work around this issue. Thank you so much.